Hey listeners, it's Nick from Kevlar Joe's Coffee Company. I want to invite you to try something new. Here at Kevlar Joe's Coffee Company, we have a bold and slow-roasted coffee that is 100% organic and ethically sourced. There are no pesticides or fungicides from the plantations we import our coffee from, and it's all single-sourced too. We have light, medium, and dark roast. Even decaf coffee as well to satisfy whatever kind of coffee you drink. We also have a variety of flavored coffees for you to try, including our hazelnut and apple pie flavored coffees, which are both big sellers. You can order our coffee at www.kevlarjoes.com. You can also follow us at Facebook, Instagram, or X for Kevlar Joe news, deals, and your daily dose of coffee-related memes, so make sure to like and follow our pages. And I'll leave you with this, listener. The world isn't a safe place right now, and it seems like it's always teetering on the edge. But don't forget, like it says in Matthew 5:14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill and cannot be hid. Let your light shine before all men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So be bold, be humble, and be Kevlar.
My name is Elliot Margioli.
This is Dr. Aaron Judkins.
This is Trey Smith.
This is Ryan Peterson.
This is Dr. Judd Burton.
This is Timothy Albrino.
This is Derek Gilbert, and you're listening to The Dig Bible Podcast.
Glad you made it. Come along for the ride as we search for hidden truth, explore historical context, and dig into God's Word to help us understand the past, present, and future of this supernatural world. This is Steve, along with Justin and Ben, and you are listening to the Dig Bible Podcast.
What's going on, all my local guys and gals and long-distance pals?
We're back!
We are back.
Without a little Steven, role reversal.
Yeah. I think Steven said he's going to try to jump in if he can get on later.
Yeah, he got suckered into coaching soccer.
Coaching?
It was a funny story. He coaches something, you know, he's coached in the past. And right. He said this year he told him, I got too much going on. I cannot coach. And his son's coach was like, you're going to be at the practices and games anyway. Just be my assistant. Just help me. So he agreed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, That's right before the season started. That coach's work schedule changed. So he said, hey, man, you're going to have to be the head coach. I can't make the games.
Oh, man. So he's got to coach all of them?
I think it's just his youngest son.
Okay. Yeah, because I know his wife's doing the girls' Bible study at church. That's where my wife and the kids are.
Mm.
So at some point, I'm sure they'll come crashing in here. Hey, Dad, what you doing? But how's things
hey,
with you?
Check out the new shirt. I got you on a shirt now.
And a hat.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's the Esau Incognito.
Incognito?
Yeah, because he's got sunglasses on. And his hat, it says, hello, my name is. And then red, it says, not Esau.
Okay. Okay. Not me. Yeah. That's work.
It's actually picking up. The first few months of the year was kind of slow to spoil me.
Did
so
it?
Now it's like wide open.
Same in the heat pump world. Getting warm. We've been busy, busy. But
yeah, everybody's turning their ACs on for the first time. It's starting to warm up. A lot of issues.
Yeah. Fun is fun. Got to do something, though.
Job security.
Pay them bills, son. Buy more Jeep parts.
Yeah. I've always said I don't need the money, but the people I owe do. So.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we're doing, Judges, we're going to try to do 7 and 8, maybe 9, I guess, tonight.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see how far we can get in about an hour.
Yeah, or less.
Yeah.
I'm tired.
lead us off in prayer, and then we'll take off.
Dear Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for this beautiful weather you've given us here in East Tennessee, hopefully everywhere else. Lord, please guide us as we read your word. Give us the words that you need us to speak, and please help us reach as many as we can. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. So, yeah, it's been a while. We switched to Enoch, and then we realized, hey, we didn't finish Judges.
And I've been doing both, bouncing around.
Mm-hmm. So, are you wanting to read or you want me to read?
Let you read.
Okay. All right, so we left off on chapter 7, so we'll pick up there. And the subtitle says Gideon's 300 men. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Harod. And the camp of the Midian was north of them, by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now, therefore, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead. Then 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. And the Lord said to Gideon, people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And any one of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you. And any one of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, shall not go. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as laps a dog, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouths, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men whom lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand. And let all the others go, every man, to his home. So that the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets. And he sent all the rest of Israel, every man, to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. And that same night the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant. So I guess let's pause there at verse 11, and we'll talk about what's going on here. So Ben, you're the military man. We got some military action here. What's your take?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you've got a bunch of people who don't want to fight and their heart's not in it, you don't really want them fighting with you, right? Because they could, not saying that they would be in hindrance, but they could be in hindrance. You know, they don't put in all the effort because they don't want to be there, right? And obviously, like it said earlier, God's dwindling his forces on purpose so that the Israelites won't boast and say, hey, look at us, we're super, you know, badass, for a lack of words. We kicked their butts. So he's dwindling it. And then obviously he's talking about when they get to the river to drink, or to the water to drink, that the ones that cupped their hands and kept their eyes out in watch. You know, obviously it's going to take, you bend over and stick your mouth in the water and start drinking. You know, you can drink a whole lot faster, but you're unaware of anything around you. So, and you're super vulnerable at that time. So the ones that did that, he also sent home. So it at the same time, by God testing them this way, you are removing the unskilled warrior away without I mean, in a sense, you're doing it without embarrassing them, kind of thing. You know, hey, God said, you know, who cups and drinks to keep, and he said who didn't, I need to send home. You know, it's no hurt feelings, not like we all, you know, over there drinking like dogs. What good are you? You know, I mean, he might have said that, I don't know. But, you know, but with that, you know, cupping and drinking, I want to say I've heard it before, but it might just be a story that talks about this kind of, or this moment. I've heard, like I said, it was almost like they drank with their spear or sword still, like, pretty much they're kneeled down, but they still have the hand on their weapon as they're drinking, where they're even more aware and ready for a fight in case they get ambushed, in a sense. Because when it comes to water, everything needs water to survive. So they teach us in the military, that's the last place you want to be, is at a water source. If you have to go to one, you be there for the least amount of time that you can, that, you know, possible. And at the same time, speed-wise, just sticking your face in the river and drinking, you know, get you some big gulps and move would be faster. But
well, what was the purpose of staying away from the rivers?
Well, it's because everybody... That's a water source. Down. Well, you're easily caught there. Okay. You know, if say you're the enemy coming into my territory or
your
my
guard's
country,
down at the watering hole.
Well, you're drinking, but I know you need water and I know where the water is. So I can set an ambush for you at the water, which in return, the looking around, cup in the water, drinking, they're watching for an ambush, possibly, instead of just lackadaisically, hey, take my clothes off, take a bath. You know, you don't do that. So at a military stand, you know, viewpoint, that benefits Gideon with the more, it would even probably be more the senior military guys who's, you know, been in it longer, more mature in war fighting would be the ones kept in the water.
Okay. So, yeah, we see God here dwindling the numbers. You know, number one, that way it's when they do have victory, it's more supernatural and they can give the credit to God. But I like how you say at the same time, it's him whittling down the not so good fighters and just getting his, you know, mightiest warriors and smartest ones.
Yeah.
And then also you have the 300. You know, it reminds me of the Leonidas and his 300.
Yeah, the Spartans.
Mm-hmm.
It does. But, and this, I guess this happened definitely before that, did it not? Maybe the same time?
I'll tell you the truth, I don't know.
I've never looked that up. Because, Leonidas and all that. That would have happened before Jesus.
Oh, yeah. This is way before Jesus, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is.
So this might have happened first. And then as we say, you know, maybe the Spartans use this story to kind of influence their own. Not saying that the Leonidas thing didn't happen, but the number 300 and them 300, that's just interesting.
And the whole symbolism with numbers, too.
Yep.
But one thing I see here in my notes that I think is worth mentioning, it says in verse 3 where it mentions Mount Gilead, it said the Hebrew text here reads Mount Gilead, which is Har Gilead. This may have arisen from a misspelling of Mount Gilboa, which looks similar in Hebrew. Does the placement of the encounter in Jezreel Valley suggest that the location is Mount Gilboa? Alternatively, the reference to Gilead could be another name for the spring where Gideon camped. at the base of the mountain. The modern name of the spring called Harod is in A Galud in Arabic, and is not uncommon for Arabic place names in Palestine to preserve ancient names. Little Paul Bark fun fact for you. But if you're afraid to go down to the camp with Parah, your servant. You shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, the servant, the outposts of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. When Gideon came, behold, man was telling a dream, comrade. And he said, behold, I have dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled in the camp of Midian, came to the tent, and struck it so that it fell, and turned it upside down, so that the tent lay flat. And his comrade answered, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of this dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian to your hand. And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put the trumpets into the hands of all the men and empty jars, torches inside the jars. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, and I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of the camp and shout, the Lord and for Gideon. Here we have the guys going to basically do a scouting mission and check out the other army's camp. And they describe how this was just a huge army with countless men and countless camels. And here's another soldier have a dream. So there's already doubt in the camp of this large army.
Right. And my version says clay jars. So they carried down, they went with the ram's horns and the clay jars. So, and the torch was in the clay jar. So the torches are lit, but the clay jar is hiding the light. But I, you know, just knowing there would be enough light shining downwards through the opening of the clay jar that there would still be light to where they could see the walk, but not enough to say, hey, here I am approaching you, right? So that's pretty interesting. And the way they split them up and gave everybody torches back in this era of time, and even the Romans, you would have, it'd almost be like a flag bearer or a drummer in the Civil War. The torch holder was the guy everybody followed. So not everybody would carry a torch. So with everybody having a torch, the 300 seemed like a giant army. So that would almost be like 300 companies of men. So they just exploded their numbers because it's dark. And you know, and as we read before, there's already that little concern and hesitation in the camp. So they're already kind of scared as it is.
Yeah, and it talks about interesting. The study notes about dividing the men that way they look like there's more.
Right.
But it says in the notes for verse 16, it says the torches inside the jars, and it references Genesis 15:17. And it says, when the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. says that that was the same word used, but it says that it appears to describe a similar item. The jars prevent anyone from seeing the torches in the night while Gideon's men move. They also prevent the torches from blowing out in the wind. Yep. The jars, after functioning as camouflage, then function as a means of noise to startle and confuse the Midianites.
Right. I mean, that makes sense because when they crush them to let, you know, to be able to show the light, you're not expecting. I mean, that would be like a modern day army rolling up, ambushing you, and then start ringing bells. Like, what the heck is that? You're not expecting bells. You're not expecting clay pots to bust when you're being attacked. So that would be confusing. Like, what the heck is that noise? Oh, crap. Look at all these lights.
So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came out of the outskirts of the camp at the beginning, the middle watch, when they had just set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets, broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches, and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and they fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. The army fled as far as Beth Shittah towards Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tebeth. The men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and the Asher from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites, capture the waters against them, as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb. Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. Then they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. So it looks like a flawless victory. Even turn them against themselves.
Right, and like I said earlier, were they, because they attacked, you know, 300 men against however many they had, which you've already spooked them and terrified them, but they still, you know, went in to attack them as they ran away. So you would want capable warriors to be able to do this. You know, so you lost as many or as less as you could. And my version makes a little bit more sense. It says, "Come down to attack the Midianites, cut them off at the shallow crossings of the Jordan River at Beth Barah." So it's almost like they were even using the waters, because obviously running on, say, a grassy field and then trying to run through a river, it slows you down a lot. So they were using the rivers to their advantage to slow them down and be able to capture them and kill them.
Just like Deborah did a few chapters back. Remember, yep. She set the battlefield for in the river plains.
Oh, yeah.
And the Lord brought the rain, the chariot's wheels got stuck.
Yep. Pretty, you know, and which I guess is just gruesome on my part, but it's, I just kind of think it's cool that they cut their heads off and brought them to them. Yeah, it's just like an ancient. Yeah, that's just like a, you know, like we was talking about the 300 in the movie. You know, the messenger rides up with all the heads of the kings they've conquered, you know, off of his saddle. So it's kind of, that was just kind of the thing they did in them days.
And one thing too is, like, when you look at verse 22, you know, you can't miss the fact that it says that they set every man's sword against his comrade. So it's dark. They think they're surrounded. They hear these trumpets and the men running. They just whip out their swords and start swinging out of fear and being frantic. And then they end up hitting other swords in the dark. And little did they know, it was their comrades at arms. They were fighting each other, killing each other.
So just after midnight, after the changing of the guard. So that means you got a fresh new guard taking watch, right? So they're not totally aware. They're just waking up. You know, in the military, we would pull guard like every 2 hours and take turns. So the best guard, obviously, to get is the very first guard or the last guard duty, because you get a solid however many hours y'all are going to be able to sleep without interruption. The worst was the midnight or like the 1-2 o'clock in the morning, because it split your sleep time completely in half, right? So also by this, so they're probably, you know, kind of drowsy, groggy a little bit, just coming on the guard, not really aware of everything yet, because they ain't been there. You know, you've been on guard for 2 hours. You're walking around for 2 hours. Okay, that's supposed to be there. That's supposed to be there. You know, and then the cracking of, you know, the jars, the lights, the trumpets. You've got the guard, which it doesn't say how many people were on guard. You know, in wartime, say wartime on base, you might have 5% or less pulling guard, right, on the interior of base, because, you know, it is what it is. But you have your guys on guard on the perimeter. That might be 25% of your force on guard. Now, say we're not in a fortified base, you know, so this would be like a castle or something like that, right? So say, and I'm talking more of when I was in Iraq, you know, you had guard on, you know, pulling the outers, and then you kind of had like a roving guard on the internal part of the base, just walking around, making sure, you know, everything's doing like it should be going. But when you're out in the field with no structural fortification and you're in hostile territory, you might be pulling 75% guard. So that would be 3 people up while 1 person sleeps, right? So we'll just assume these guys are doing, let's say they know Gideon's out there, right? Because they're talking about it. Oh, you know, I had this bad dream. So they might be on 50-50. So you got 50% of, we'll say 50% of them just woke up, while the other ones who are kind of tired are now going to sleep, right? And you start to nod off to go to sleep. The next thing you know, you're awakened by the trumpets and the lights and all that. You're going to be like, wait a minute, where am I at? And then they're already terrified, you know, practically. So, yeah, people start jumping out of their tents, running around, swords already drawn. Then this guy bumps into that guy. Next thing you know, they turn around, they're cutting each other. I mean, it could happen easy, I'd say. And I'd say it happened a lot during this time frame and this style of fighting, when it was swords and shields and stuff like that. So
yeah, and one interesting fact that I found, I thought was worth mentioning, it says that it's got like their nicknames of these rulers that they beheaded.
Yeah.
And it's in a commentary I got on Judges. But it says that Ori was known as the Raven, and Zeb was known as the Wolf. The Raven and the Wolf.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, yes. Ready for chapter 8?
Chapter 8, yes, bud.
I feel like Wayne off Wayne's World. Camera 1, camera 2, camera 1, camera 2. Remember that?
I don't think I've ever watched it.
You've never seen Wayne's World?
No, I don't think I have. If I have, it's been a long time ago.
Yeah, we need to have early 90s movie night.
Okay.
Late 80s, early 90s.
We could do that.
All right, it says a subtitle here, Gideon defeats Zeba and Zalmunna. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this that you have done to us? Not to call us when you went to fight against Midian." And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abzir? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and his 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. And I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with the briars." And from there he went up to Peniel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Peniel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Peniel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, and who were left of all the army of the people of the east. For there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Jogbeha and attacked the army. For the army felt secure, and Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. So I guess that's a good stopping point to have a little discussion. So he's traveling through these lands and conquering them, and he's got all these men that are hungry and exhausted, and he asks the people of the land for some bread, and they basically refuse him. They're like, "You ain't our king. You haven't defeated our king, so therefore we're not giving you nothing." And he's like, "Well, when I come back, you're going to regret that." Right. Pretty much.
Yeah.
And I like how you mentioned earlier, too, that, you know, Midian is a land of dark-skinned people, and that's where Moses fled when he left Egypt. So these were people that were familiar with the God of Israel and the Jewish people.
Right. I wrote down that that's where Moses fled to when he fled from Pharaoh, and it's in modern-day Saudi Arabia, just below Jordan, or even possibly maybe parts of lower Jordan. And I Google mapped it, the distance of roughly around where the battle happened. and just kind of clicked close to where it said Midian territory was. It's about 300 miles. It said, obviously, Google Maps, you know, it shows you how far driving distance. So it would be a 6-hour drive. I mean, when we were in the military, we would walk. I mean, they wanted us to walk like 4 miles an hour. So 12 miles in 3 hours was the standard. But, you know, which again, they probably could do that, if not faster, if they were just walking, because they didn't have rucksack, body armor, you know, all that kind of stuff. They had a shield, a sword, a spear, maybe. You know, they might have had some kind of something to carry food with or something, a sack or something maybe. But they would definitely be lighter weight. And I would say twice as in shape as we are today. And so, I mean, just say they could go 40, 50 miles a day. You know, that's a 6-day journey, you know, just getting it.
Yeah. And what is a marathon, like 26 miles?
Oh, I have no idea.
I remember that Greek battle that we supposedly got, you know, that run from, that they were losing a battle, and they sent this guy who was supposed to be the fastest, best runner to run to Greece to inform the council to send more soldiers that they were about to be defeated. And that guy ran 26 miles straight and got the army, and they came back and ended up winning the war there.
That's crazy.
So I mean, these guys were used to running and traveling these great distances.
I mean, 26 miles, you said?
I think so.
So 4 miles an hour is walking. So say he might have been running maybe 6 to 8 miles an hour. You know, 4 hours straight running. They got there, and say 6-7 hours of them marching back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know, after gathering everybody up and going.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name, but yeah, that's where the whole idea of running the marathon came from.
Yeah, and I can't remember. It's one of them guys we've interviewed. I can't remember. At least I think it was. I remember seeing somewhere, and I was thinking it was one of the YouTube videos we did, where they say that even the oxygen level back in this time and earlier was higher, so you didn't get fatigued as easily as you do now. But
yeah, I mean, I'd say you didn't have as much pollution and stuff back then, so the air was definitely cleaner. But I believe you're talking about trees. Kent Hovind was talking about the pre-flood world, before the flood. Okay.
I think that's what it was. Because they found the fossil, and the oxygen level inside of it or something was, or a rock or something like that, that was sealed.
And it explained all the huge pre-fauna and giant and long lifespans, yeah.
Right. So that was totally off topic then.
Yeah. It's all good.
Yeah.
So I guess 13.
Okay.
Says, then Gideon, the son of Joash, turned from the battle by the ascent of Hears. And he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars with him, taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Peniel and killed the men of the city. And then he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? They answered, As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king. And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you have saved them alive, I would not kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise yourself, fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna. And he took the crescent ornaments that were on their necks of their camels.
Wow. So there wasn't no empty promise there.
No. There was definitely follow through.
Yep.
This was not Washington, D.C. empty promises.
Nope. Sure wasn't.
And he basically, these kings call him out and try to bluff him and say he's a coward. You know, don't have your son do your dirty work. You do it.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And then he took the necklaces and the trophies.
Yeah, he has to at that point.
Yep.
Royal ornaments from the necks.
Yep, took him his trophies.
Man.
Oh, and that's what it says here in the notes. It says for verse 26, the crescent ornaments and the pendants. While Gideon may be seeking payment for his military service by asking for gold, the use of it to make an ephod suggests that Gideon is setting himself up as the highest authority in the land. Because right here, the next line, it's subtitled Gideon's Ephod. It says 22, it says, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And Gideon said to them, let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil. They had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread out a cloak, and every man threw in his earrings for his spoil.
Okay. On mine, in quotations, where it said they collect, it says plunder, collected the plunder of the earrings. It said the enemies, being Ishmaelites, all wore gold earrings. So every soldier they killed had gold earrings, I guess.
Yeah, they were Ishmaelites, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it says. So that's why they had earrings, because that's just what they did.
Like a culture thing, tribal thing.
I guess, yeah. Like the Vikings had their little bracelet ring, trust bracelets or whatever they called them.
I thought those were for arthritis. Well, had a little half circle with the beads on it.
If they're copper.
Yeah. It might have been because of the maxes. All the maxes they were swinging, they had arthritis in their wrists, and they were the ones that came up with that.
Well, close. You'd wear it on your ankle for your wrist. Now this is like legit. Dad wore one when he was in the army for a little bit because one of his knees was hurting. And they said wear it on the opposite wrist of what knee hurts. I have no idea why, but I remember Dad saying, because I asked him, why do you wear that? Now, he could have been just telling me a bunch of bull, but I don't know. But I just,
the power of suggestion is a very strong thing.
Yeah, I was young, and I remember him saying that. So it's not, I am not a clinical doctor. I am not giving medical advice.
We'll be sure and put that disclaimer up.
Yeah.
So verse 26, they lay out the cloaks and give the earrings. It says, and the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold.
Mine says about 43 pounds.
Okay. Besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city, in Ophrah. And all of Israel poured after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon, to his family. So Midian was subdued for the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon.
That there's interesting.
Yeah.
So you got obviously 40 years, and we've said this many times, right? And after Deborah was 40 years of peace, if I still have my other notes,
we'll see. Rain 40 days, 40 nights.
Yeah.
Wandered the wilderness for 40 years. You know, 40 is a number of like basically great reset, new beginning.
Yeah, I don't have it written down for any of the other battles before this, but
well, see, we assume ephod, we think of the priestly ephod, you know, that the priests of Yahweh wore. But here in the notes, it says that where it didn't specifically say it was a ephod for Yahweh, that this was a type of sacred object used in divination, attempts to discern the wills of God. Gideon's ephod was gold. An ephod made of a silver plays a part in the events of Judges 17 through 18. That ephod was set up in a shrine next to the household idols. So this was a snare. So this item was either worshipped as a god, or it was an idol made for another god.
Right. So my version, I'm in the NLT version, the halfway, well, say 27, Gideon made the sacred ephod from the gold and put it in Ophrah, his hometown. But soon all the Israelites, it says, prostituted themselves by worshiping it. And
okay.
It became a trap for Gideon and his family. So
yeah,
I'm assuming it was some kind of statue or something that was like out in the courtyard or whatever.
Well, that commentary that I got on Judges, it actually has a note for this here.
Okay.
It says that Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in his city of Ophrah, that no idolatrous use was in view, nor any device course from Shiloh contemplated, is manifest from Judges 8:33. Gideon prospered, so this was not a false idol at that time, because he was blessed. It says, and with the gold he received to make an ephod for his use only as a civil magistrate or ruler, as David did in 1 Chronicles 15:27. It says, and as a magnificent pectoral or breastplate also. It would seem from the history that he was not blamable in making this ephod as a civil robe or ornament merely, but that it afterward became an object to which religious ideas were attached, whereby it proved a snare and constantly an evil by perversion to Gideon and in his house. So originally it was like a king's robe, a status symbol of authority,
right.
And it was later perverted into a religious item.
Huh. Like worshiping what Gideon did instead of what God did, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I guess.
And then also, I mean, it's a pride thing.
Right.
Because he was suffering from that anyway, because he was having his men say, you know, for God, for Yahweh, and for Gideon.
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time the soldier said something in praise of God or for God, they also added for Gideon.
Right.
And he was a human.
And that's kind of the same thing with David, right? Saul killed 10,000 men, but David killed, or 1,000 men, and David killed 10,000. You know how they would sing when they'd come back in from battle before David had to run off? It's kind of not saying that. You know, obviously Saul's God, but you're adding that, you know, hey, praise to God, but also praise to Gideon.
Yeah,
you're almost, it's almost like you're giving Gideon more praise than the God in that aspect, which in return, you know, between Saul and David, Saul obviously grew bitter to that and then tried to kill David. You know,
it's just, yeah, we're all human. We're subject to pride and jealousy.
Yep. For sure. And the itch for power.
Oh yeah. And absolute power corrupts. Absolutely.
Yep.
All right. So we'll finish up here. We got a few more verses.
Yep.
We'll put a ribbon on it. Okay. Verse 29 is in the subtitles, the death of Gideon. Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, at Ophrah of the Abrazite.
Mine says Abzer. Yeah.
So 33.
I was reading some of this at work, and I was telling Zach, like, man, who come up with all these names? Which to them, it's normal, you know, but they're so hard to say.
33 says, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel.
In the same time, where it says, as soon as Gideon died, my version says the Israelite prostituted themselves by worshiping images of Baal. So it's using the same language as up above with the ephod. They so they worshiped it. You know, they corrupted themselves tainted themselves by worshiping whatever ephod he made. I'm thinking it's probably like a statue or something that was left there, kind of thing.
Well, it uses the word ephod. It was basically like a chest ornament or like a kingly cloak.
I guess, would it be on like display then?
Oh, I'm sure they maybe put it like on a statue or something for people to look at.
Okay. So, and then same thing with worshiping Baal. They prostituted themselves.
And the word Baal, you got to be careful with the context, because that word means Lord in Hebrew. But right. the notes for 33 here that I got, it says, the Baals, the Hebrew text here is plural, indicating multiple Baals. And this is likely a reference to multiple idols and worship sites. Baal can mean Lord or refer directly to the Canaanite storm god. It said, made Baal Berith their god. This god's name means Baal or Lord of the Covenant. And in 946, it's got a reference note here. There is a reference to the god El Berith, meaning El or God of the Covenant. The connection between these two references suggests that the Israelites had made a covenant with Baal or El, with one God whom they referenced with both titles. Their covenant was supposed to be with Yahweh. El was the creator God and the chief deity of the Canaanite pantheon who fathered Baal. And you have the whole Baal ruling on Mount Zaphon, Mount Hermon, with his divine counsel, which was his 70 sons.
Interesting.
And the whole Deuteronomy 32 worldview.
Right. And what I also find interesting is they forget about God that easy, right? But they had all the gods they kept falling back from Egypt. Now the Canaanites, you know, as they traveled through the land of Canaan, when they come into Israel, it's like still today, you know, we go to church, we read the Bible, but we fall into worshiping money and other things that are worldly that we know better, but we just do.
And we have that with a modern view, right. But I'm of the opinion that it was like literal. If you had these people that was seeing God do all these amazing things, parting the Red Sea and bringing all the plagues,
right?
They're still turning these other gods. It's because they're seeing stuff.
Something.
There's a payoff. Yeah. Something is pulling them away. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it has to be something. Because, you know.
Them to sacrifice their children, you know, right. And all these things.
It's not like, just say, for instance, I watched, you know, the mountainside was falling down on our property. And I physically seen angels sent by God barricade off the house and the land flowed around the house and nothing was harmed. And my whole family survived, right? Seen it with my own eyes, knowing, whoa, those were angels. And then 10 years from now, I'm out here bowing down to my Jeep, kissing it. I mean, that Jeep didn't do nothing for me. You know what I mean? Why would I ever do that? So I could see something to where something had to have happened from these other lowercase g gods to deter them and to lead them to try to worship them instead.
I agree. Well, man, I enjoyed it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Keep digging along with us. And Ben, pull us out. Until next time,
keep digging.
Thanks for listening to the Dig Bible Podcast. All you dirty fingernail theologians, we appreciate you. Be sure to check out our YouTube, our Instagram, our Facebook, and our Twitter accounts. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. And wherever you listen to us, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, be sure to give us a rating. That really helps us jump up so other people can find us. Keep digging.
Hey guys, this is Steve from the Dig Bible Podcast. I really hope you guys are enjoying the content, but also the sound quality. It's drastically improved since I handed that duty over to the Handcrafted Audio. If you've enjoyed the quality of the show and have any audio or editing needs, reach out to Jason at thehandcraftedaudio@gmail.com. And as always, keep digging.